Thanks for tuning in to Public Radio KDNK. This is the Living Permaculture Show. I'm Stephanie Sison, here today with guest co-host Gwen Garcelon, a good friend and also a public affairs host here on KDNK. So first, I'd love to welcome you.
Thanks.
And thank you for joining me here, Gwen.
Yeah, always love to talk with you and Woody.
All right. And so our guest for today is Woody Tash of Slow Money. He's the founder and chairman of the Slow Money Institute, a nonprofit dedicated to catalyzing the flow of capital to local food systems, connecting investors to the places where they live, and promoting new principles of fiduciary responsibility that bring money back down to earth. Woody is also the author of multiple books, including his newest, Soil, Notes Toward the Theory and Practice of Nurture Capital. So I'd love to welcome you to the show, Woody.
Thank you so much.
Great. So you have been visiting, and you have visited our valley many times, but quite a bit over the last couple weeks.
Yeah.
Right?
So, I like nice places. What can I say?
And we do have that, don't we? So we, you were out at the Aspen Business Connect meeting, which I was at as well.
Yeah.
And then last week here at the R Day event, what was the panel that you were on? I didn't end up making it to that event.
Well, it seems like every year at the renewable energy event, they try to have a few sessions on agriculture, food systems, the kind of nexus between various issues, soil carbon and other energy, the carbon implications of agriculture. So I'm often there. Brooke Levan is often there, and a couple of the other usual suspects. But it's really a conference that's about renewable energy, not about food per se. We're just a little kind of a sidebar.
It's interesting to me that it's taking a while, it seems like, for people to really catch on to local food as a real necessity for the future, that we develop local food systems as a means of survival. Is that conversation anywhere that you see?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny. I just found out that the Federal Reserve published a book last year called, I think it's called Harvesting Opportunities. I hope I have that right. But it's they commissioned a survey of local food stuff around the country. I think they refer to it more as regional food systems, but they talk a lot, they use the word local a lot too. I just kind of looked it over earlier today. And, they are, let's say, aware that food systems are kind of pivotal to healthy local economies. And there's a bunch of other reasons I think politically they got involved in this, but it's just interesting. So, yeah, I mean, they're basically documenting the fact that local food, what you're saying, the conversation is getting bigger. More and more people are talking overtly about, expressing their demand for local food in different ways. And so I think the answer to your question is yes, even mm-hmm. though there's been some plateauing of farmers markets and CSAs and whatnot. Overall, I think the trajectory is still up.
Great.
And Woody, Gwen and I, and you actually, before we went on air, were talking about how I was just having a lovely rhubarb cocktail over at the Marble Distillery and how shocked I was that still people didn't know what slow money is. And so I was discussing who was going to be on the air with me today. And, Woody of Slow Money. Slow Money, what's Slow Money? And to me, that seems, especially in a town like Carbondale, everybody knows what it is. And yet that's not necessarily so. So just to get us rolling, I'd love for you to explain for our listeners who haven't heard of Slow Money what it is that we're talking about.
Yes, there are probably 29 million Americans who haven't heard of slow money.
Crazy.
Actually, it's funny because I was speaking at Stone Barns, the food center outside New York, the Rockefeller-funded food center. That is, it's a pretty tony place, a lot of thought leadership there and whatnot. And I was giving a talk on the book, and there was a woman in the audience who, during the Q&A part, she said, "Hi, I'm here. I've never heard of this before, but I'm so glad I'm here. And I work in finance in New York, and I'm just like, I can't believe that you're not bigger. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is so obviously critical. How come you're not bigger?"
Right.
And I said, well, hold that thought. Change doesn't always come that fast. But anyway, we've been around for 10 years. We're actually, I'm just drafting a letter to some of our key stakeholders and whatnot on the occasion of our 10th anniversary. this little movement called Slow Money started in response to my first book, which was called Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money, Investing as if Food, Farms, and Fertility Mattered. And as that title indicates, it was reflections on kind of the disconnect between our mentality as investors and what needs to happen on the ground. I mean, literally on the ground, in the soil. This new book is a continuation of that thought process based on the last 10 years of activities around the country. So we've been around for 10 years. We've just passed the $65 million mark into 728 small food enterprises. We're promoting small, local, diversified, organic agriculture and all the little businesses that bring that produce to the local market. So it's all about local food systems, community resilience, carbon in the soil, diversified production. You know, diversity is very critical. You know, pretty much every food company as it scales drives diversity out of the food system kind of by accident, fairly major structural problem. So anyhow, that's what we're doing. We've got a few dozen groups. The way this is happening is highly decentralized. No one's in charge. I'm just kind of the kind of cheerleader. We have local groups in a few dozen communities. We have a group in Carbondale. If anybody listening doesn't know that, it's called the Two Forks Club for the North Fork of the Gunnison and the Roaring Fork Rivers. We've got over 30 members. I should have checked these numbers before we got on, but what I do know is this past year we made over $100,000 of loans to 7 small food enterprises in the region.
Well, in that Two Forks Club, a lot of the guests on this show have been recipients of those loans. So Christian and Harper from Two Roots Farm, Casey of Wild Mountain Seeds, even Biodynamic Botanicals, which is the medicinal herb farm that I run. We had a no-interest short-term loan that helped us purchase some more efficient irrigation systems for the farm. Really, really amazing work. And that's just like kind of the tip of the iceberg of what that
group. So just while we're on that particular thing, I think we should just highlight it because it is one of the things I'm very intrigued about going into our Slow Money second decade, which is this idea of groups of people who donate money, take a tax deduction, and then by majority vote of the members of the donors, make 0% loans. And if anybody's listening who knows about finance, that will kind of
break their mind a little.
Well, not totally. I mean, there are nonprofit revolving loan funds and whatnot, but I should just say a little more. And I'm just going to say about what we're doing in Boulder now, just to expand the regional context a little bit. I'm talking to you from Boulder right now. I'm a member of the Two Forks Club and basically started it with local Carbondale resident Susan Brady. And it's been a great experience. And I sometimes say to people, it's the most fun thing I've ever done that has anything to do with money. And the reason is we have the donations. In the Two Forks Club, the donations range from $150 with no upper limit. And we have donors who have put in between $150 and $80,000. And everybody comes in, sits next to each other, and everybody gets one vote no matter how much money they put in.
And if somebody wants to become a member of that club, how do we get them connected to Two Forks?
Well, so Two Forks has a website. Slow Money has a national website. So if you go to slowmoney.org and you go to our local groups page, you'll see a Colorado section and you'll see Two Forks mentioned in there.
Great.
And then we're taking that same model. We've been doing it for about 4 years in Carbondale. So now I'm doing it in Boulder under a different name called Slow Opportunities for Investing Locally, which happens to spell soil, which is, you know, why I made that the title of the book, both the actual soil and the soil project. And we're doing the same thing, just on a slightly larger scale. You know, the Front Range has more people, more deals, whatever, so we're trying to do it a little larger scale. So we've raised $235,000 from 75 people, in amounts ranging, in our case, from $250 to on up, and our largest is $50,000 over here. And we've just made our first loan. And I don't want to get in the weeds on that unless you want to hear more. I just want people to hear that it's happening. It's intriguing. If we are able to get between 100 and 200-ish, there's no magic to these numbers, just money coming in, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year coming into these little initiatives, and we make 0% loans, of course we're going to have losses, but you just continue that activity out and then the loans that get paid back cycle back in, and let's say year two, three, and four. Eventually, if we stick with this for a generation, these pools will have quite a few millions of dollars in them. It is truly slow money. It's very slow, it's very long term, and it would represent a very unique community controlled resource for small scale.
You know, it's just so fascinating to me seeing this local investing mirror, you know, local food and local economies. And is that, you know, it seems like that's all part of the same trend. Do you see that as a strong trend?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's like anything, I guess I'd say. There's a lot of talk and not that much action in general. It's, you know, change is hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are... Our patterns as investors, whether you have just a 401k or you're an angel investor or an ultra high net worth person, wherever you are, you're a foundation trying to figure out how to invest your foundation assets. It's while there's a growing awareness of, oh my God, you know, Wall Street is somewhere between, you know, out of whack and scary, let's say, or just subject to collapse, you know, to more volatile than ever with a quadrillion worth of derivatives. However you see that, there's that. Then there's the local food movement, which is coming up from the grassroots saying, look, this is really important. It's cool. We want our communities to be more resilient. We don't want only a few percent of the food we consume to come from here. We don't want to be dependent on long, complicated supply chains that are not transparent and all kinds of other things. So you have these things going on, but actually translating that into action is not that easy because we're talking about money, and money is kind of scary and triggers all kinds of things, you know, primal fears and existential risk and all kinds of things. So local investing is coming up, local food's coming up, but you know, we're barely on the radar still in the scheme of things. So we have, and you know, it's kind of the circumstances, political circumstances, cultural circumstances. I mean, it really calls on us to get this to happen a little faster. I mean, we do joke, if anybody's listening and they say slow money, well, you named it slow. It's not because it's lack of urgency.
Right.
Slow means thinking long term, not needing fast returns. But the pace at which we act, we'd like it to be, you know, as fast as possible.
We're going to pop in there for a second. You're listening to KDNK. This is the Living Permaculture Show. We are here with Woody Tash talking about slow money. And his new book, Soil. So, Woody, at the Aspen Business Connect meeting, you shared an excerpt from your book that was really moving to me. It was about returns. And I don't know if you have it handy, but I have it handy if you want me to read it for you. But I'd love for our listeners to hear.
You can't read from my book.
I can read from your
book.
No,
you can't. I have to read from my book.
I'd rather you read from it, but I'm certainly prepared to do so.
So I do happen to have my book handy here.
Perfect.
So, but I'd like to read you know, three excerpts. Two of them are, one is semi-short, one is really short, and then there's the return one.
Okay, well, yeah, whichever one you're feeling called to share.
Well, it's just they give, you know, this whole process for me, I've just had, you know, myriad conversations with people of all kinds, farmers, financiers, and everybody in between about the issues that we've just touched on a little bit. So this book is my effort to kind of just pull 10 years of public conversations together. And I went pretty, well, I can't say deep because that'll sound like I'm congratulating myself for being deep, but I went as deep as I knew how, I can say that. And the first part of the book is a kind of a zany, I guess I might say, mythic poem called Poetically Incorrect. And the second part is called Imagination. And I did that because, to me, what we're talking about is a cultural revival of some kind, or a cultural awakening, or a cultural shift. And it's only going to happen if large numbers of individuals actually change the way they're thinking about food, money, soil, culture, community, democracy, all these things. Anyhow, so these excerpts are just a few different shots at the target that will give people a feel of how I did it. And I might have said at the event we were at, Steph, and Gwen, you were there too, that I did realize when I finished the book that it has a style, and that the style is lively serious as opposed to deadly serious. Mm. So there is quite a bit of wordplay in these passages. I hope people will enjoy it. So the first one, the first passage is a little bit more serious, and it goes like this. This is not about numbers, doing these numbers versus doing those numbers. This is about reaffirming the primacy of words over the claims and our attention made by numbers. Reaffirming the primacy of relationships over the claims of transactions. reaffirming the primacy of nutrition over the claims of cheap calories, reaffirming the primacy of places over the claims of markets, reaffirming the primacy of generations and seasons over the claims of milliseconds and algorithms, reaffirming the primacy of putting back in over the claims of taking out. And I actually realized as I was reading that, that's not a very lively series. That's just a serious passage.
That is a serious passage.
That's not that lively. to the liveliest thing in the book is the first couple of words when you open the front page. It says, if it's true that we are what we eat, may it also be true that we are not what we tweet. And so I put that at the very beginning just to kind of warn people that this was going to be a playful approach to some very serious topics. All right, and then the section you asked for, Steph, the return section, is the beginning of a chapter in the book called Return, and it goes as follows. And this, I do believe this is lively serious. At least I hope so. Salmon return. Boomerangs return. Hindus return. When things work out, investments return. Letters with insufficient postage return. So do infections, mosquitoes, prodigal sons, wandering eyes, sideways glances, the hands of a clock, circular reasons, not quite infinite seasons, pendulums, memories, criminals to the scenes of their crimes, and stories to where they left off. Prior to the advent of colony collapse disorder, bees returned. Heroes, real and mythic, return. Odysseus, Columbus, General Douglas MacArthur. Too many winks, verdicts, and tennis serves have been returned over the course of human history to be counted. The same goes for sweaters after Christmas. And as long as there have been neighbors, economists, democratic entanglements, and governments, there have been many happy returns, diminishing returns, election returns, and tax returns. Through it all, however, through all these physical, spiritual, emotional, postal, historical, mythical, electoral, recreational, and commercial goings and comings, there is one thing in our infinite industrial wisdom and pioneering spirit that we have not returned: carbon.
Yeah, that, I think, at least for me and the folks that I spoke to at that event, was one, a really great glimpse into your writing style and the humor yet seriousness of it. But carbon, that's something we're talking about here. I don't know if you've read The Carbon Farming Solution by Eric Tonesmeyer, which is an amazing textbook research study on different forms of agriculture in all across the world and their effects on carbon, as well as many other things. But our farmers, a lot of them here, are doing some really good work to be returning that carbon to the soil.
Yeah, I mean, people are definitely going to hear a lot more about this over the next decade than certainly in the preceding decade. This is not just like a quirky little issue of some, you know, I was going to say, Steph, biodynamic weirdos, but I caught myself, but then it came out anyway.
You can say that. We're a little weird.
So,
in other words, this is not just for a small group of deeply concerned people. This is a global issue. And I think the easiest way to get people to kind of wake them up to it is to say that the plow, you know, the implement that is identified, the iconic implement that is identified with, you know, the America, the breadbasket of the world, and the heroic small farmer that turns into the big agribusiness thing, the plow is actually one of the instruments of climate change, because in plowing soil, you release carbon into the atmosphere. And so it's kind of like we didn't used to know that cigarettes cause cancer, and then we figured it out, and it was hard to get everyone to stop smoking. So it's going to be the same thing with plowing. It's not going to be easy to get people to stop, but there's a whole movement called no-till agriculture, which is just focused on that, minimizing the disruption of the soil while cultivating. And, you know, so there's a whole lot of stuff that's going to come out about it, but I think people need to just kind of be aware that if you pursue biodynamic or organic farming practices, you are actually taking carbon from the atmosphere where we have too much, and putting it back into the soil where we don't have enough. And when there's carbon in the soil, it holds water better, it's more fertile, et cetera.
So this is something that, you know, someone making a choice to spend however many of their food dollars at a farmer's market supporting a small, you know, local organic farmer, can be doing more so than, you know, just supporting their local food economy. It's actually bigger than that. Can you connect that dot a little bit more?
Oh, my God. I mean, that's, you know, that's, I need a few hours.
Yeah.
And some of that, and some of that rhubarb victual.
You've got five and a half minutes. Go.
So yeah. In 5 minutes.
So, this is, I'll sound a little goofy when I say it this way. But given all the stuff that's going on with fake and real and fake news and all these different things that are happening now, I mean, to me, this is like, what do we think is real? Like, what do we think is happening to the world? And then what? And then can we do something about it? And to me, the realest thing there is organic farming. It's growing food in a way which is in concert with natural systems that leaves nature at least as fertile as we found her, or possibly even more fertile, which is as high a calling as I can imagine at this stage of human evolution. I mean, we're coming out of a couple hundred years of industrialization and consumerism and globalization and technology, all that stuff. And I always have to add, if I do a litany like that, I'm not against those things. I'm just against our acting like that's all there is. Like rural communities are expendable, small farmers are expendable, soil fertility is expendable. That's kind of the box we got ourselves in. So yeah, this thing, you know, the bigger picture is pretty big. I mean, it's about culture and civilization and society and community, a whole lot of things. The good news is you don't have to know all that or think about all that in order to go to a farmer's market or belong to a CSA or support a local farmer. But on the other hand, it's not bad to know all those things, because that will empower us to act more.
So your return on investment for those few dollars spent is so much huger than you could ever imagine.
Well, that's the whole point.
Yeah.
Well, that's why that section on return is important.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's really
the whole chapter there, that was just the beginning of it. But yeah, getting people to think in a way broader and deeper way about what they get from their money, what their money does, what it creates, and what it gives back.
Right.
Yeah, I think that idea of return and taking that term and really opening it up and thinking about all the different forms of return, or capital, even social capital, all of these words that we have so closely tied to money, that they mean so much more than that. I think we were just having, I was teaching for the CMC permaculture class, and we were talking about perennial agriculture, and we were talking about yields and how a lot of the resistance to perennial agriculture and staying with annual agriculture is this idea that you have this limited yield. And, you know, you walk around Jerome Osentelsky's permaculture food forest up at the Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute, and while there's, you know, less maybe edible food per square inch than some annual agriculture farms, the yields are so diverse. The herbs that are there to bring in the beneficial insects that allow you to not have to deal with pest control as much, and your time is saved that way. That's a yield, but it's a kind of a breaking of what these words currently mean to us, or a return to what they actually mean.
Mm-hmm. Of course I agree, but you touched on diversity in there. The whole, I would say, one of the cornerstones of this new way of, not a new way of thinking, but just some, you know, reaffirming some values, is that diversity is at least as important as efficiency.
Hmm.
And so, you know, everything about modern industrial systems is all about efficiency. You know, buy low, sell high, produce things as cheaply as you can, and get them to the most people, and all those things. Again, that's not a bad thing, obviously, but it becomes a bad thing if everything is organized that way, including things that shouldn't be. And one of the things that shouldn't be is a small-scale diversified organic farm. Let's just make up some numbers here, like a 20-acre farm that might be grossing $20,000 an acre, which would be very successful. But I'm saying there's some of those in Boulder. And, you know, they might be growing, you know, a dozen commercial crops and have a few species of livestock there and some bees and honey and a bunch of different things. And they are promoting diversity both in terms of the products they're growing and the life in the soil. And if you talk about diversity and life in the soil, you have to say things like billions and trillions of organisms and these numbers sound almost impossible to understand, in like a trowel, in like a handful of soil, much less an acre, much less a valley. So there's a super abundance of life in the soil, which we have been sort of ignorantly expending as we went to an industrial model. And so all of the organic and sustainable biodynamics movements are about is about remembering that and trying to move back in the other direction. Everything we do respects the diversity in the soil and then increases diversity in the food system. And, you know, without diversity, the ecosystem will collapse at some point.
For sure. And Woody, I knew we were going to run into this moment, but we are rapidly run out of time. So can you give our listeners your contact information if they want to read your book? Or
if you wish to rush out to buy this book, you don't have to rush out. You just go to slowmoney.org. You'll see the book page there. I do like to mention we self-publish the book, so all the proceeds stay in our nonprofit Slow Money to fund this work.
Beautiful.
And I hope many of you, you know, will find it a useful tool in thinking and doing.
Great. Well, I will leave you with a quote from Woody, I believe. Products produced cheaply create ugly work lives and ugly households and ugly communities. Profit produced quickly cannot purchase patience and care. Patience is beautiful. Restraint and care are beautiful. Peace is beautiful. A small, diversified farm is beautiful. So get out and visit one of the many small diversified farms we are lucky enough to have in this valley. And I wanted to thank Woody and Gwen for joining me today. This is the Living Permaculture Show on KDNK, and we will see you in a month.
Hey, Steph and Gwen, thank you so much.